You're listening to the Maritime Gardening Podcast, Episode 71, brought to you by Vessi Seeds and Safer's Gardening Products. Well, folks, today we've got a special guest for you. I'm wrapping up the Season 3 here of the Maritime Gardening Podcast, and I brought back star guest to the show, Robert Pavlis, author, blogger, YouTuber, teacher, guru, speaker of truth, Robert Pavlis, author of the books Garden Myths and Building Natural Ponds, and Gardening Myths 2, which is in the works, hopefully available sometime around Christmas. But if you know anything about writing books, sometimes these things don't go as planned. Yes, Robert?
Well, I'm hopeful, but Santa Claus may not come this year.
Yes. And speaking of books, just a note to the listeners. I've got another guest, hopefully before the end of the season. If you go to Robert's blog, I think it was on the Garden Myths blog. He's got two blogs, Garden Fundamentals and Garden Myths. And I believe it's on the Garden Myths blog. You did a book review of a book called The Ever Curious Gardener by an author named Lee Rich. I think he's in New York.
Yes.
And your book review is very positive, and you're a very critical guy. I mean, people don't follow everything, but Robert has a Facebook page. What's the name of your Facebook group?
Garden Fundamentals.
Garden Fundamentals. Okay, so Robert's got a garden Facebook group called Garden Fundamentals, and I post stuff on there once in a while, and he doesn't pull any punches. Like, if he thinks I'm wrong, he'll just come right at me. He doesn't hold anything back. So Robert's, you know, he's a straight shooter, and he's fair. So he gave Lee Rich's book, a pretty good pass. And Robert's not going to guy. You basically scoured that book looking for to see if he'd, echoed any garden myths. Yes.
Well, he paid me a lot of money to say those. I know Lee a little bit because we were both writers, and I've read a lot of his articles.
Right.
And he's written several books, so I know him from the books. I don't really know him personally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've ever had a real life-to-life conversation,
right.
So that's how little I know. But over the years, I've learned that when he writes something in a magazine or something, or his books, there's very little in it that I would criticize.
Right.
Factually, it's accurate. He's a horticulturist. He's got several degrees. So he's very careful about what he says to make sure it's really right. And the other thing I like about him is that his advice is very common sense, and
right.
that kind of aligns with my own thinking that, you got to make this thing simple. And so I got his book. To be fair, he did ask me to review the book.
I talked to him on the phone just a few days ago, and he said he asked you to read the book because he knew you wouldn't, throw him any bones.
Yeah, and I read every line in that book looking for mistakes because I would really enjoy criticizing Lee. he's one of, in my mind, he's one of the most knowledgeable horticulturists around.
Right.
And so it's a challenge. And there are a few things in the book that I don't agree 100% with him on, 99.5% of it, I have to agree with.
That's pretty good. You can't ask for much more than that.
And a lot of it, and the areas that we don't agree are areas that, aren't well-defined anyways in science. So it's not like I'm turning around saying, well, you're wrong with this, and that here's these studies that prove it. There's a lot of things in gardening that haven't been tested, and we don't really know the answers, and so it's very easy to have different opinions.
That's what I gleaned from your review, that there are claims that are just, there hasn't been a study to back it up or refute it either way. There's just no particular scientist has turned his or her eye towards that in a sort of controlled experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So any book that any articles and books he's written, you can be pretty sure that the information is valid.
Yeah,
and there aren't many people that I can say that about, right? So it's it's worth reading.
That's great. No, so hopefully we'll have Lee Rich on the show. I don't know. Next, he sent me a book. I haven't got it yet. I gotta read the book before I talk to him. So apparently the book's in the mail, and hopefully we can make it happen before the end of the season. If not, we'll do it early next season, because I have Vessi Seeds, one of my sponsors, has re-upped to sponsor the show for another season. You know, putting a show up like this, the podcast hosting costs money, and Vessi Seeds has covered the cost of that. So I'm able to. What's that?
That's great.
Yeah, so I'm able to do this for another season, and that's great. And that's of course some of that money goes towards costs associated with producing the YouTube videos that people like and all that sort of stuff. So that's just great to have another season sort of secured and ready to roll. So, moving forward, topic of today's conversation with Robert Pavlis. If you go to his blog, Garden Myths, which I have to say, it's the only blog that I refer. I'm not just saying this to make, to make Robert feel good or to to build Robert up, but it's one of the places I go to look. Moreover, if you Google a question, does this do that? Does this work? Is this good? Is it bad? You know, like things like that. You just Google a general question about gardening. I'm not going to say 9 times out of 10, but more often than not, I find the answers to the kinds of questions I ask tend to come up, like, when Google does a search, one of the first things are, among the things that appear on the page I can see, so like one of the first 10 things will tend to be something from Garden Myths or Garden Fundamentals, which is pretty good. I mean, if Google says you've got the answer, Robert, you're making some people happy. I mean, it's basically to some extent you're getting hits, and people that's a place people are going to look for answers, and also there's just traffic on the site, so it's working really well.
Yeah, well, we're approaching 5 million views.
That's amazing.
Probably before Christmas, so it's been working really well.
Yeah, they're great. Certainly, the Maritime Gardening Podcast isn't quite there yet. So thanks for coming on my show. So speaking of Garden Myths, if you go to one of the drop-down menus, there's one called List of Topics, and I just noticed this a week ago. I can't remember what was on my mind at the time, but I just ended up on Robert's website. As a thing, says, don't buy these products. And that's right up my alley, right? Because, if you watch my YouTube videos and you listen to the show, I'm really not, most of the time, I'm not saying buy this or buy that. And one thing that really irks me by a lot of garden protagonists or garden gurus or personalities that are out there is they're always trying to tell you to buy this, buy that, buy this and your garden will be good, buy that and your tomatoes will be more red, do this, do that. And I don't really see that as the role of anyone, whether you're a garden enthusiast. That's how I would define myself. I don't have Robert's background on this topic. I'm just a guy with a big garden that loves to grow food, and I'm excited about it, and I want to get people into it. I want to help. But I don't have a long list of credentials behind my name related to horticulture. I don't have any. I just read a lot and try a lot, and it's all trial and error. But anyone engaged in trying to help people grow, their job is not to sell you stuff, to say buy this and buy that. It should be more about technique and educating you about what conditions tend to be favorable towards growing the things you're trying to grow. So what I really like about this particular page, don't buy these products, is it lists a lot of things that it's easy to find people saying, buy this stuff, it's great. And so we're going to talk about, we're not going to talk about everything on the list. We're going to talk about some of the things that I noticed on the list that I've always had issues with and thought were ripoffs as well. And I guess, are you ready to dive into this, Robert?
Yeah, just pick one of the topics and we'll talk about it.
Okay, so we'll start with the top of the list. This might have been the top of your list, is bone meal.
Bone meal. Yeah, it's on the top of my list a lot of the times. Bone meal is basically calcium and magnesium. Phosphorus and calcium.
Okay.
Very little else in there. The problem is most soil does not need either calcium or phosphorus. It has enough.
Yeah.
There's a myth about the fact that if you add excess phosphorus to the soil, it'll make more blooms, larger blooms. That just isn't true. That will only happen if you don't have any phosphorus in your soil, which is a fairly rare situation.
Your soil would have to be just devastated by some event or some over cultivation or something, I suppose.
Well, really, really sandy soil could have that condition.
Right.
And there are soils around the world, certain areas that are phosphorus deficient. But in North America, most soil is not.
Right.
And if you're adding compost or manure or anything like that to your soil, then you're not deficient because you're adding enough phosphorus. It's also recommended for bulbs, right? You must put bone meal in the hole before you plant your bulbs.
Right.
I don't know where that comes from. Bone meal does nothing really for your bulbs. Again, it doesn't need the phosphorus. And in fact, bone meal attracts rodents.
Oh.
So it's more likely that your bulbs be dug up by squirrels if you use bone meal.
That's certainly a problem where I am.
So there's very little use for it in the garden.
I've heard people argue that you should put it, like when you're planting, let's say you buy a plant in a pot at a garden center, like a flower or some sort of large thing that you're going to transplant, and you know, you dig a hole and you stick that thing in, and I've heard people say, oh, put bone meal in there, it'll help the plant get established. I've never done that.
No, I haven't either.
Okay.
You don't, again, there's this myth that it does something special, makes roots grow and makes flowers. None of that is really true unless your soil is phosphorus deficient.
Right.
Okay, if that's the case, then you do need to add some phosphorus. But a much better way to do that is with some sort of phosphate fertilizer rather than bone meal.
Right.
But again, we don't have that problem. The average gardener does not have a phosphorus deficiency.
Well, I mean, and most of these, so all of these things that you list, you have on your list, these are all things I don't do either. And all of them are things I've decided not to do just almost through like an internal logic check. And something like bone meal, how I could not get there. I didn't read about it or anything. I just thought, like, if your soil is healthy and there's all kinds of living things in there, then those living things are these things don't live for hundreds of years. The living things that are in your soil die all the time. So there's things living and dying in your soil all the time. And things like calcium and all those other sorts of things that are in those living things end up in your soil, right? They're, especially a garden like mine, you've got a mulch all the time, those living things, everything's sort of feeding on the decaying plant matter, and some things are eating other things and killing other things, and things are living and things are dying. And I would imagine that many of the things that are in bone are in the exoskeletons of the things that are dying, these small life forms, and all those things are going in the soil anyway.
Yeah, all plants and animals and insects and bacteria, they all have phosphorus and calcium in them.
Yes.
And when they die, that gets added to the soil.
Yeah. All right, so that's bone meal. Now, this is something I'd never contemplated, but based on what you wrote, I thought, man, like if there's this much noise out there saying it's something you should buy, I bet you there's a lot of people that think it's a useful thing, and that's vitamin B1.
Yeah, B1 is an interesting product. I think the reason people like the idea of using it in their garden is that they know it's important for their own health.
Okay.
And something that's good for us must be good for the plants and must be good for the garden.
Well, like push-ups and jumping jacks.
Yeah. So what happened, this is in the 30s, some 1934, I think, if I remember right. A researcher tested some seedlings with vitamin B1, and he seen that roots grew better.
Right.
And that was picked up by the Home and Gardening magazine.
Yes.
And they showed some very large pictures of, you know, really, really big roses and a few other different types of garden plants. And everything was flowering really great. And underneath it said, vitamin B1 added to the plants. It's a miracle cure.
Boom.
Boom. Right? And it took off. And Super Thrive, which is a very common fertilizer, was one of the biggest proponents of this, and they had it in their product for many, many years. what's really interesting about this is in around 1936, 38, so only a couple years later, the original researchers had done more investigation and concluded vitamin B1 isn't doing anything to the plant roots. Okay, it's not going to affect plants. And they published that. So they're very honest. They look, you know, our initial research showed some things, but adding B1 to your plants is not going to grow better roots, is not going to make better plants. The problem is, and this is a problem with many of the myths, is that nobody ever read that. You know, no magazines went and had front page articles, hey, B1 doesn't actually work. They forgot about it. And people have been promoting this for, well, since the 30s.
Right.
Now, SuperThrive did stop advertising it on their fertilizer, oh, maybe 10 years ago. And now they've replaced it with kelp. So now it's a kelp extract that's magical.
The new magic thing that goes into
it's,
it.
Yeah. It's the new magic, yeah. So, in fact, when some other researchers tested vitamin B1 against water, they actually found that the B1 plants grew less well than just straight water.
All right. Well, that's,
so that's how good it is.
That's the end of that one.
But you can go on Google. I just did that an hour ago just to check. There's all kinds of fertilizer that still promote B1 in their formulations.
My goodness.
So there's lots of companies still advertising it.
I honestly think, and maybe it's a function of our culture, but we just seem to crave one thing solutions, you know, like, oh, just, you know, put an egg under your tomato plant and it'll be massive. And all these weird, something about like the miracle, so, the snake oil. We're begging for the next snake oil as a culture. We'll do anything for the next snake oil.
That's why Garden Mess will never go out of business.
There you go.
There's always a new one on the market.
You got a winner, Robert. All right, so the other one, and this is very near and dear to my heart, and I'll talk about this a bit, but I'll let you talk first, is landscape fabric.
Mm-hmm. So landscape fabric is really liked by certain groups of people. Landscapers love it. They put it down, and when they leave, the landscape looks great. And for the next year, maybe 2 years, it still looks great. Very few weeds. Low maintenance, everything looks great. But you come back 5-6 years and it's just an absolute nightmare.
Exactly.
It stops, the weeds come, the roots of the plants grow into it. If you want to try to get rid of this, it's terrible.
It's impossible.
So what I find is that new gardeners who have just used it think it's lovely, and experienced gardeners who had it in the past just hate it.
Yes.
Bottom line is, it's not really good for the garden because it actually prevents water from getting into the soil where you have it.
Mm-hmm.
When you do pull it out, you damage all your roots, especially from woody plants. And it just doesn't work. It doesn't stop weeds. Within a very short period of time, weeds grow on top of it.
Yeah. And through it.
So it just simply doesn't work.
Yes.
But it's still being sold, and you can buy it in every nursery and lumber store. They still sell it, and lots of people use it.
There's a certain logic when you look at it. You think, well, that'd probably work. And you see the tiny holes. You think, well, water will get through it. And, if it's the thing about the tiny hole is that, roots can go through tiny holes.
Yeah.
I spent 2 summers. So, right now I've got a full-time job. I work for the provincial government, but for 3 years I was working part-time teaching at the university here. And in the summers I ran a business, I call it a landscaping business, but I really wasn't doing landscaping. I was building, the idea of the business was to build permaculture gardens for people, right? I'd go in and set up a hookah culture bed, or I'd set up a permaculture garden with a mulch, and I'd sort of coach the client through how to use a garden, like a no-till garden, a low-maintenance garden. I'm not doing it anymore, so it's a relatively small market here, and it's not a fairly, Nova Scotia, generally speaking, isn't an affluent place, so it's the kind of client I was looking for, someone that would throw ridiculous amounts of money at me to help them grow vegetables in their backyard. I couldn't find too many of them. But some of the work I got just to sort of, you know, get some extra money, I found much more work just fixing people's flower gardens, which I hated doing, which is the other reason I'm not doing it. I could have made a living if I had about four guys working for me and all I did was fix people's flower gardens. There's a demand for that, but I have no passion for that at all. So you go into these flower gardens, and every single one of them would have this useless landscape fabric, and it's exactly the way you're describing. There would be weeds everywhere, and the weeds would be rooted right into it, and it would not come. It would come out in pieces, and all that. It's completely non-biodegradable, and so on and so forth. And then you'd have to argue with the client and say, look, this stuff, look at it, it doesn't work. How about I just put some, a couple layers of paper or cardboard down and put a mulch on top of that, and it'll smother out most of the weeds. And any other weed that manages to persist through this would have persisted through your landscaping fabric anyway. But the difference is that when this cardboard breaks down and I go to pull that weed, it'll come out because it's not anchored 6 inches beneath the soil in this membrane of non-biodegradable stuff that lives forever. Some of them I could talk into that, but yeah, I hate the stuff.
Yeah. Most seasoned gardeners do.
Yeah.
And it's when you're in social media and you're getting comments, I think a lot of the positive comments come from new gardeners who haven't had it very long.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, 3-4 years down the road, when it's a problem, they don't come back and correct their comments.
No,
right?
No, because no one's ever wrong.
But I talked to any experienced gardener, and you're very hard to find someone who thinks the product is good.
Well, also, I notice sometimes, like, I'll roll up to a Tim Hortons or a McDonald's or, whatever, some place like that to get a coffee. And they always have these, like, little crappy gardens along, because I certainly don't go to a fast food place to look at their gardens, but they usually have some little lousy garden sort of outside. And 9 times out of 10, they got mulch, and there's little pieces of that black stuff sticking out.
Yeah.
And I even have some neighbors down the street here where they've got these gardens with mulch on top, and there's all this landscaping fabric sticking out of the mulch because every time we get a hard rain, it pushes the landscape off the mulch, and the mulch becomes exposed, and then the rain, the wind picks it up and starts blowing it all over the place.
Yeah, it's unless you put a really thick layer of mulch on, it's not nice looking.
No. So, what's the next one here? Anvil versus bypass pruners. This is something also I'm an evangelist for, a big fan of the bypass pruners, and I don't understand why people buy anvil pruners.
No, and for a long time I didn't know why they buy them either. When I researched it, the only thing I can come up with is that if you're cutting up dead wood that's already cut off a tree and you're just cutting it into smaller pieces, it may cut thicker pieces because of the design.
Oh, because it's kind of like breaking it as opposed to slicing it.
Yeah. So an anvil pruner should never be used on a living tree or a shrub.
I would agree.
Right? You want a bypass pruner. The other thing that I haven't written about yet, but it's on a very long list of things to write about, is that when you use a bypass pruner, there is a correct way to hold the pruner when you're cutting a branch.
You mean like relative to the main stem?
Yeah, you want to make sure that the cut goes through the branch so that the part that remains is not damaged.
Yeah.
And so what it means is, depending on which side of the trunk you're on, you have to twist your arm around and do it one way or the other, which is really kind of awkward.
Yes.
But if it makes more sense when you look at it, listeners, next time they go out to prune some, just have a look and see if they're going to damage the branch on the good side, then they're holding it the wrong way.
Yeah, so I mean, for those that are unaware of the two different designs, an anvil pruner, the sharp edge pushes against a flat piece of metal, almost like an anvil. And the bypass pruner, the sharp edge goes alongside of the other part of the pruner, almost like a pair of scissors is slicing. But one side of the pruners is not sharp. All the cutting's being done by a sharp edge on one side, and the other side almost looks like a bent finger, is one way of putting it. And so the bent finger part goes against the cutting, the thing you're trying to cut, and it pulls the slicing part towards it. And so that the part that's grabbing onto the thing you're cutting, you want that on the end that's going to be thrown away, so that it's not bruising the remaining part that stays on the plant.
Yeah.
So you can't do that. That's impossible to do with an anvil pruner because it's going to bruise both sides, right?
Both sides. Yeah. So bottom line is there really is no use for an anvil pruner. I don't know why they sell it.
No.
You know, it's really, everybody should have bypass
pruners. Maybe they're
pruners.
Cheaper. I mean, I have a bypass pruner, and it's one of those high-end ones you get at Lehigh Valley. I can't recall the name of it. It's like a Swiss.
A Felco.
It's a Felco, yeah, Felco number 8 or something like that. It costs like $50. But, I mean, you buy one of those, it'll last you, geez, it might last you your life. And even if you don't know how to sharpen blades, the blade will last years, and you can replace the blade part for, I don't know, $6 or something like that. Yeah. So they're definitely worth the investment. It's the ideal gift for a gardener for Christmas. So the other thing here is mycorrhizal fungi. Robert, since you're more the horticulturalist than I am, why don't you explain to the listeners that haven't heard of this, and I've mentioned it before on my show, and I've tried to talk around it a little bit, but it's very important to permaculture gardeners for sure. But how about you just talk around mycorrhizal fungi a little bit?
Okay, so mycorrhizal fungi is an organism that actually infects virtually all plants out in nature. Trees, grasses, perennials, they all have a symbiotic relationship with this fungi. And what happens is the fungi connects with the roots of the plant, and it provides nutrients, a lot of it being phosphorus, and water to the root of the plant. And in exchange, the plant gives it sugars, because since fungi don't have chlorophyll, they can't produce their own food. They have to get it somewhere else. They're getting their sugars and their food from the plant.
Right.
And what it means is that the plant has an easier time to find nutrients and water. And you can think of a plant root as being a fairly thick thing relative to the fungi, and the fungi are these fine white filament hairs you sometimes see in the soil. And they go everywhere. They go in all the nooks and crannies of the soil that roots have a hard time getting to because the roots are just too big.
Right.
And this is a very important association that takes place in nature. There's no doubt about that.
That's just about as elegant and concise a definition of mycorrhizal fungi as I could expect to get. Yeah. I like to think that I've got a pretty good population of it in my soil, as one of my more recent YouTube videos I revealed that I hadn't watered my garden since early July. And, you know, certainly it's not like we got a rainstorm every week here, and we certainly had many weeks where there was fire bans. You weren't allowed having campfires and stuff like that. So at some level, I mean, the mulch helps, but I also think that it's that connection, right? That ability of the plant to sort of plug in, and use the mycorrhizal fungi to sort of extend its reach and get what it needs. I mean, I can't prove that for sure, but I didn't water my garden since the middle of July, and everything's fine. So.
Yeah, it's really important in nature. And so we have this thing that we've studied, we know it exists, it's great for plants. And so no doubt a manufacturer comes along and says, well, if it's good for plants, I'm going to bottle it and sell it to you.
Yeah.
And so now we have to ask a completely different question. Do we need to buy this and add it to our gardens? And in most gardens, the answer is no. If you have an established garden, and you've been growing things in it, and you've been adding, again, manure and organic material and compost and all those sorts of things, you already have these fungi in your garden. Okay, you don't need to add any more.
Yes.
So then people come along and say, well, what about special situations like a new development where homes are being built and the land, the architect comes along and takes all the topsoil away and big machinery compacts all the soil and you're left with really crappy soil in your garden, the fungi don't grow there. So the argument is, well, you go out and buy some and you put it in your soil or you put it around the roots of plants as you plant them, and then you'll have the fungi growing. The problem with that is if the soil isn't good enough to grow fungi, the ones you buy and put on the soil are simply going to die.
Oh.
Right? The thing people don't really understand is that fungi move around really easily. They make spores which travel through the air and go long distances by air. So, for instance, mildew on plants is also a fungi.
Yeah.
And it gets spread around by the spores floating around in the air. So you may not have a lot of fungi in your soil, but that is because when the fungi land there, they don't find an environment where they can grow well.
I see.
And if you buy it and put it there, they're not going to grow either.
Right.
Okay.
So the more important thing is to have a the environment that your garden is, like the environment you've created in your garden should be one that supports and is conducive to that sort of, to the proliferation of those fungi.
Right. So that you have to start by improving the soil.
Yes.
You know, again, compost, manure, etc. Once the soil gets better, the fungi arrive all by themselves.
They just fly in there.
Okay. And if you really doubt that, go to the woods and get a handful of soil and bring it home and spread it around your garden. Okay, it's full of fungi.
Right.
Okay, a handful of soil has billions and billions and billions of fungi spores in there. You don't have to buy this product. So you mentioned earlier, maybe while we were offline, that you're seeing it in all the products now. A lot of the bagged soil has it in it. It's being added wherever it can. It's becoming really, really popular, but it's not doing anything in any of those products.
Right.
There was a study done on the West Coast where they looked at not just mycorrhizal fungi products, but also other products that have organism in them. So they could be different kinds of microbes, bacteria, they looked at about a dozen different products, and they actually found that most of the products did not have the organisms in them that they were supposed to.
Right.
Basically, you were buying nothing. You were buying nothing. Some of them never had it in because they actually tested it with DNA studies. And a lot of it, the fungi were dead.
It died.
Because if you buy the bottle and it's been sitting around in, it's too hot, for instance, heat will kill mycorrhizal fungi.
Right.
So if someone's had a bottle of this sitting in, a greenhouse over the summer,
right,
it gets really hot. When you buy it, it's dead. And you can't tell by looking at it. It's just a powder.
How would you know? Right? Yeah.
And it's not a cheap powder, so you don't know that you're getting the product you're buying, and you don't need the product.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I've talked to three people, researchers, who actually study mycorrhizal fungi, and without going on record, they all said, yeah, I don't think that product is worth buying. Because they say it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. That was my thought. I was watching a guy on YouTube, and he was planting something, and he was like, oh, and you got to put this in to inoculate the soil. And I'm like, why? My understanding is it's ubiquitous in nature, and it's like every natural growing system in nature runs on this stuff. Every forest, every ditch, So why would I need it in, the soil that's right next to all those natural systems? Wouldn't it just be there? And even if it's not there, I'm pretty sure it would find a way to move in fairly quickly if conditions were conducive.
Right. The other interesting thing is that mycorrhizal fungi do not grow well in soil with high phosphate levels.
Over fertilized.
Well, either over fertilized or you use a lot of bone meal.
Oh, the bone meal again.
You'll actually inhibit the mycorrhizal fungi.
Right.
Right. So they will die off if you fertilize too much.
Yeah, well, that's one more reason to stay natural.
Yeah.
All right, so that brings us to our last thing on the list here, and this is rock dust. And this is another thing I have seen some fairly prominent online garden gurus pitch, rock dust. And I remember the first time I saw someone speaking to this product, I thought, it's rocks. You know, that was the first thing I thought. Just the most basic insight was like, it's rocks. So how much sand is rocks? You know, it's just like, how much good could it possibly do? So I don't want to steal your thunder here. Robert, you go.
Well, rock dust is mined in certain areas. Some of it is of volcanic dust, so the remains of old volcanoes. And we have some of those in North America where people wouldn't think of volcanoes, but these are, you know, millions of years old.
Right.
And the soil that's left is this fine dust. And so if you take this dust, it's full of nutrients. I mean, it's got everything, right? Phosphates and calcium, magnesium, manganese, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing wouldn't have is nitrogen, but pretty much everything else it has that plants need.
Full of a lot of minerals. It's probably mineral-rich.
That's right. Yes. So that sounds like a good fertilizer, right? I mean, the elements I just listed sound just like fertilizer. On the other side, you have this problem that people are aware of, and that is that as we garden and farm, let's use the word farm, not garden, as we farm the land, we keep harvesting and reducing the nutrients. And so our soil is becoming, has lower and lower nutrients all the time. So we have to replace those nutrients, and we might as well use this rock dust. So if we put rock dust on those farmlands, we replace the nutrients and everything grows much better. Well, there's a couple really key questions we have to ask here. The first one, which really surprised me, is this. Are the nutrient levels on farms actually going down? And I wrote a blog post about this, and I did quite a bit of research. I'm still not 100% certain of this. But no one's contradicted me, so I feel pretty confident. The actual nutrient levels on farms is actually not going down, except possibly for some of the major nutrients like phosphates. All of the other ones, there's still lots there in the soil. The reason our soil changes on farms is mostly due to a lack of organic matter,
right,
and a change in soil structure. So we lose the structure, we lose the organic matter, but there's lots of nutrients there. If we think about it, our soil is made up of rocks. It came from rocks. So there's tremendous amounts of nutrients. Now, they may not be readily available to plants, but there's still lots of nutrients.
Right.
So I think this whole idea of our nutrient level going really down is probably a myth. Okay?
Right.
Farms fertilize because they want to maximize productivity. And so they're adding some of these fertilizers to get really high yields, not because there's nothing left in the soil.
Right.
But that's farms. So if we go back to gardeners, I then ask the question, how quickly are these rocks decomposed? How quickly are these nutrients made available to plants? Because it's quite different. I mean, let me give you this example. I take a bone left over from dinner and I throw it into the garden. I can come back 100 years. It's still there.
Right.
Right. It just doesn't decompose. It's lots of nutrients, but it doesn't decompose.
Didn't you do a thing on your blog where you buried an egg? Is that you?
Yeah, that's my egg experiment.
To see like how long it took the calcium in the egg to sort of become soil, and it was a surprising amount of time before it.
Well, I'm just finished year three of a 6-year study, and I dug up the eggshells a couple months ago, and they look as whole and as new as the day I put them in 3 years
ago. They're not like paper thin, or
no, really? They're not getting thinner. they're not getting pop marked. There's no holes in the shells. they're not decomposing. And I'm not entirely surprised. I'm really doing it to prove to people that this is true, because archaeologists dig sites that are 100 years old and find the eggshells of chickens and ducks and so on. And they not only find the shells, they can identify what type of bird these people were eating.
Right. So, well, the shells are in pretty good shape.
If the shells were decomposing, they wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Right? But they're still there. So anyways, then the question comes up, well, how quickly does rock decompose? How quickly does the dust turn into nutrients that plants can use? And
slower than eggs.
Well, I can't get an answer to that. I've contacted numerous manufacturers of rock dust, and nobody has an answer. Nobody's actually studied this, apparently.
Right.
But they're pretty sure it works.
Right.
Right. So you'd think that if you were a manufacturer of rock dust and you're claiming that this helps the soil, well, wouldn't I go out and get myself a field that, you know, has low nutrients, maybe a farm that's been farmed for 100 years, throw a bunch of rock dust up there and then measure the nutrients and see how quickly, how much did the nutrients go up after I added rock dust?
Not if everyone's buying it anyway.
they don't do this kind of studies. In fact, the one company I went to a conference, in fact, this was the organic conference in Guelph, and I asked the person that. I says, well, haven't you done that study? And he says, well, that sounds like a really interesting study. Maybe we should think about that. So as far as I can tell, there is no scientific evidence that shows that rocks will decompose anytime quickly. And some estimates are in the range of maybe in 100 years, you will get some value out of this rock dust.
Right. So, I mean, I would think that when I think of a rock dust, and I think of an extraordinarily fine rock dust, I would think of clay, right? Like a clay soil. If you take soil, or, you know, if you take a bunch of earth out of the ground that you think is clay, and you put it in water and you shake it around and you sort of, you know, agitate it, and so it arranges itself into different strata. The finest of that strata is the clay.
That's right.
So, I mean, clay is rock dust. It's just like it's as fine as it can possibly get. And most soils, certainly where I live, my whole damn garden is clay. That's rock dust to me. You know, sand is like, you know, not fine rock dust, and clay is super fine rock dust. If you go anywhere in a forest in Nova Scotia and dig down about a foot, because it's not like Ontario where you are, where you've got like all this beautiful soft soil and stuff. It's all rocks here. So you get down about, if I go in the woods in my backyard, it's like a boreal forest sort of thing, all you know, evergreens and stuff like that. And you dig down, the first foot is like pine needles, and then it's white clay and giant rocks. That's all it is. It's just white clay and giant granite rocks everywhere. To me, that's clay is extremely mineral rich.
Yes, it is.
So why would I, if I've got all that clay everywhere, why would I be dusting, you know, a sort of inferior, I've got basically excellent rock dust all over the place, and then I'm dusting like inferior rock dust on top. Certainly the worms and things that work the soil, they're at all those different levels, and I'm sure they're moving between the level of you know, the top layer and the middle layer and the lower layer, and they're sort of moving around depending on the temperature and so on and so forth. So I'm sure they're bringing up stuff from the clay level and, you know, sort of pooping it into the rest of the garden and going back down and moving around.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, when we look at this dust and we look at clay, it looks very fine to our eyes, but on a microscopic and an atomic level, those are big, big pieces,
yeah.
Right? Atoms compared to a piece of clay is still so much smaller.
Right.
And until that atom becomes free from the clay, plants can't use it.
Right.
Right. It has to be a single atom, a single ion, before plants can really make use of it. So that rock dust has to decompose before it can be available.
It's got a lot of work to do to get down to an atom.
Yeah. So I want to see that's really why I did the egg study, right? eggs are put into the garden and they disappear. And the every gardener says, oh no, my eggs have completely decomposed. I can't see them.
Right.
And well, yeah, but our eyes are kind of useless at looking at small things. And so once the eggshell is a certain size, it looks like a grain of sand and you're not going to see it.
Right.
That doesn't mean it's decomposed into calcium.
Right, yeah, it didn't just turn it. It's some kind of calcium carbonate or something like in a form like that, but it's still just that. It's not it's not broken down into a finer element. It just looks like it has because you can't see it anymore, but
Now with the eggshells, I do want to say that my soil is alkaline and in very acidic soil, so we're talking below 5.
Right.
The eggshells will decompose more quickly.
Because it would have a chemical reaction with the acidity.
Yeah, yes. the acidic soil helps decompose the calcium.
Yes.
But I'm guessing that anything above, even at below 5, the eggshell has to be ground extremely fine before you'll see an effect on soil.
Right.
If you take large pieces and throw them on an acidic soil, they're still not going to decompose.
Right. Oh, because, yeah, by grinding it up, you'd be increasing the surface area and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know. There one more thing I wanted, since this one's running a bit long, I might have to break it into two pieces, but one thing I noticed on your website is that you listed the... what would you call that? Like those garden rake things that it looks like a hand. What's that called?
You know, like a cultivator?
Yeah,
a
hand cultivator. And I've always, I'm guessing people use it because it looks like a hand. It's like, well, I can just hang on to that and I won't get my fingernails dirty. And if you actually do any, serious gardening, if you have a teeny, tiny flower garden, let's say 2 feet by 6 feet, and that's the only garden you have, you could probably use one of those, I guess. It's still not a good tool, but I mean, you're not doing it on any scale, so it doesn't really matter what you use. You probably use your hands would probably work better. And I would say, most of the time in my garden, I use my hands more than anything else. Robert basically says, I can't remember what the word, I can't remember exactly what you said, but it was funny. It's just like, I don't understand why people sell these or why people buy them.
Yeah, and they always come in a set. That's what gets
with,
me,
with
right?
a couple you, other useless tools.
Well, you have a little trowel, which you can use, and then you get this little hand rake, and then there's usually a third. There's always three in a set for some reason.
Yeah.
And two of them are absolutely useless as far as I'm concerned. Now, I did have some people write in and comment on the blog post, and they use it in container gardening. Ugh. Because it's small, so it they can dig around in there. But for a real gardener with any size garden, it's a pretty useless tool. And besides, who wants to bend over down to the ground? If I'm going to use that, a small rake or something, I'm going to use one with a long handle.
Right, so you can...
even that end on a long handle would make some sense to me.
Right,
because one side is usually like a hole, and the other side is these three-finger things. But when it's only 6 inches long, you're going to lay down on the ground so you can use it? I find that there's so much stuff being sold, not just in gardening, but everywhere. So much stuff being sold and people, they flock to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always ask myself, do I really need it? And what is the impact to the environment? Like everything you buy impacts the environment. The packaging has to be made from oil. This little trowel has metal in it that has to be mined. It gets mined. We use energy to mine it, to smelt it, to form it. Then we ship it all around the world. It's probably made in China and then shipped over to Canada. That thing has a huge environmental impact. And then you buy it, use it twice, and put it in the shed.
Never use it again. And you just, you know, you wasted a 45-gallon drum worth of oil to get that piece of junk into your house.
So I it's not working, but I encourage people to always ask themselves, is this something I really need? And is it something I'm going to use a lot of?
I have to say, like, I do use a hand tool in my garden, but that may change as time goes on and that becomes more less comfortable. I use a thing called a Home-E gardening tool. And I'll tell you how I came across it. I bought a house years ago, and it's not the house I'm in right now. And I was working on the soil in the backyard, and this thing literally came out of the ground. It was like I discovered a magic tool. It was like that, like I thought if I rubbed it three times, a genie might come out. I don't know if you've ever seen a Home-E garden, but it looks like a plow. Looks like a plow you'd have behind a horse or something like that. And it's, I think the term actually, it's a Korean tool, and I think it literally means hand plow. And it's just it's a Bronze Age tool. It's been around that long. And, you know, it's got a little wooden handle, and it's got this sort of thing, and you pull it towards yourself. So you're using your back muscles. You're using a major muscle group. And just the way it's designed, it's incredible at moving earth around, and it's very it's far more versatile than it appears. And I just find it to be a fantastic tool. I wanted that to be the icon for my podcast picture of that, but my producer at the time, Dave, he said, well, we got to use something people recognize when they think of gardening. Right, so we went with like one of those little hand shovels, which I think the only thing I do have one of those little hand, you know, that little, it's like a spoon. What would you call that? A hand trowel?
Trowel?
It's like a spoon sort of thing. And I use that. I do have one of those. So I actually do use that, but I use it to move plants. Like if I've got, you know, something growing in one place and I'm thinning out and I need to like scoop it out of the ground and move it to another place. So you almost like you're turning something, you're taking a plant and turning it into a transplant in a sense. Like, let's say you plant, like, you know, I might plant a bunch of tomatoes fairly close to one another in my cold frame. And then once it's, late June, I take a whole bunch of them out of there and put them in other parts of my garden because they don't need to be protected anymore. So I use that. But yeah, that sort of garden rake thing. Useless. I don't even know. It's not good for weeding. It's not good for anything.
Well, that's what I thought.
I'm with you.
That's my.
Oh man. Well, you know, this has been great, and I hope the listeners enjoyed listening to that. I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad if they've invested a lot of time and energy into these things. You can go on to Robert's website, Garden Myths, and find that link there. You just top left-hand drop-down menu called List of Topics, and it'll say don't buy these products. And, you know, you can read everything he said about each one of these, and I agree with all of his arguments. And there's more than just what we listed here. There's probably 10 or 12 things I think he lists there.
There's also a menu called Don't Plant These or something like that, which are commercially available plants that people should not be planting, mostly because they're very invasive
things. Yeah. I remember when I had that, when I was doing that thing working in people's gardens, you'd have all of these people that, speaking of don't plant these, this is probably, I'm spoiling it for maybe a taste of another episode we can do next season. Don't plant these. That's a great topic. But I noticed a lot of people would plant mint in their vegetable garden.
Only once.
And only one. And, oh my God, I mean, it's impossible to get it. It's just an invincible, immortal plant.
Yeah. Mint has to stay in a container.
Yeah.
Yeah. If anywhere.
Or you plant it somewhere that's like, I have a wood pile. And I have mint in the ditch by the road near my house, because who cares? and I have mint behind my wood pile because I don't care, right? Care how big the mint garden gets there. I could care. I'd be happy to have tons of mint growing there. No animal's going to eat it, you know. But in your garden, you'd have to be out of your mind.
Nurseries still sell it. They sell it every year, and people keep planting it.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that I find very frustrating is that even the good nurseries will sell plants that they know are just extremely invasive and that most gardeners are going to hate them in a couple of years.
Yeah.
But they're probably really inexpensive to propagate.
Yeah, and I think people look at it that way, or also as like a cover plant. Oh, I can have that growing around the base of my tree and I don't have to, you know, do this, that, and the other thing. So it's going to, you know, take over and so on. So I could see why people would want to grow it, but my goodness, I mean, some of these things are just a problem you're going to really regret. Also worth reading that. We may do an episode on that maybe next year. Okay. Yeah, well, Robert, thanks for being on the show one more time for this season. I called Robert because I said, look, I'm only doing a few more. I try to wrap the season up. Probably in November, I'll do a few more episodes, and then we'll wrap her up for the season and take a little break and then come back to you probably in February sometime. But, you know, just to get a couple months off doing this and try to write my book, which is not going to be done for Christmas.
Maybe we should have a race.
I think
done first.
My money's on you. Also, I have a funny feeling that... Because a whole angle of mine is to try to do like permaculture in plain English. Because if you ever watch the videos of Jeff Lawton and these sorts of guys, I mean, it sounds like they're wonderful to listen to. I love listening to Jeff Lawton talk about permaculture because he's so eloquent. But my God, they make it sound complicated. And on top of that, they tend to talk about it as like, oh, you're going to have ducks and you're going to have goats and you're going to have. It's like. You know, most people just want to have like, you know, some vegetables in their backyard. They don't want to have ducks and goats and stuff like that. So it's the angle, what I'm trying to raise, like it's permaculture for people that it's like small p permaculture,
yeah.
And try to really bring the language of it down into just plain, you know, sensible, you know, in permaculture in plain English to put it simply.
I've never written about permaculture, and I've listened to some programs, and I even started a course once, and there's a lot of terminology in there and a lot of confusing concepts.
There's a lot. Well, I mean, I think people are drawn to it almost like it's a religion, like they're yeah. You know, like it's a they're more inclined to believe in it than to think about it. Which is a problem, right? Like anything about your garden, you shouldn't do it because you're following some leader, or you just believe, like with bone meal, you believe it's going to work. You should do it because it makes sense and it's rational and it's a good, you know, there's a good reason for it. I've done a fair amount of reading on the topic, and I'm trying to employ it in my garden. It seems to be working for me, so that it's the combination of reading about it and trying it and seeing results, and everything is easier than the way I gardened before. So that's what's turned me on to it. But my goodness, the content out there on it is all over the place, and and I have no certification whatsoever. And I think that's like the first chapter is like basically me talking about how unqualified I am to talk about this. But I consider my resume my garden. You look at the guy, so that guy's got a pretty good garden, doesn't use any fertilizer, doesn't water it for a couple months every summer. He's on to something, right? And I try to, you know, backdrop all of that against some of the literature on the topic to sort of just make it a little more digestible for the ordinary person who doesn't get a lot of time and doesn't want to watch you know, every documentary on permaculture that's ever been made and read every book that's ever been written, which is most people, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're getting off topic here, but Robert's been great having on the show a few times this season. Hopefully we can do it next season.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Well, I look forward to it.
And all those people out there, buy Robert's books and look for his next book, Garden Myths 2, correct?
I think that's what it's going to be
Hopefully
called.
Hopefully that book, like the others, will be on Amazon, available through Amazon.
Yeah, available on Amazon, both in Canada, U.S., and in Europe.
Great. All right. Well, that's good, because we get a lot of listeners in all of those places. So thanks for coming on the show, and everybody out there, thanks for listening, and until next time, get out there, get at it, and have fun in your garden.